Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from East Timor, Europe, and Australia will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us music that's too often missed by the mainstream. Why music improves health, how it can transform communities, and what's it got to do with seeking asylum. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and today we're talking with Brian Prokopis from the Sweet Freedom Music Project, an Australian social justice program that works through music and song. Brian and his colleague Simon Monsour are producing social justice music in collaboration with the people who both sing and star in the songs. The performers are themselves asylum seekers, singing lyrics they wrote about their experiences in fleeing one country and waiting to find a home in another. Why is this project so important, Brian?
Chris, it's important because of the impact it seems to have on all of us. We work with people who are experiencing different degrees of marginalisation. And just a gratifying thought to see refugees from Ethiopia standing next to those from Eritrea and Sri Lankan Sinhalese people standing with Tamils, all singing, just confirming our recognition that music has that capacity to bridge cultures.
And to bring people together. I'm wondering, in that lineup you've just described, Ryan, tell us about some of the characters in them.
Amazing characters, Chris. We work with, in this particular album that you have in front of you, we've worked with asylum seekers from various parts of the world, African countries, Sri Lanka, Latin America, Asia. And I'm just thinking of Michael, who comes to mind immediately. He's from Sri Lanka, came out here in Australia, escaped a situation where his house was bombed and his brother was murdered, brought his young wife and son out here, thinking that he'd be immediately eligible for a protection visa. But that was 11 years ago. He's still here, still waiting, and desperate. And we've just watched him, I suppose we've watched his self-esteem just crumble.
So when you see Michael in that lineup and actually singing, what does it do for him? What have you observed, and what does he say to you that it does?
Because his self-esteem was such an issue. I mean, his little boy had all sorts of health problems, and being an asylum seeker, he doesn't have access to health care or social security, whatever. He couldn't look after his family, and he just lost his identity. So to see him stand up and sing was amazing because he's a quiet person. But then we gave him the lead vocal role of one of the songs, and he proudly stood up to the mic and delivered this wonderful vocal set. So we knew then that at last he's found an opportunity to really express himself and let us all know that he can do something very well.
Because the most amazing part about these songs are that they are heavily influenced by the countries that the asylum seekers who are singing in it have come from. There's strains from all kinds of musical influences there, Brian. I can imagine that that would be a challenge in itself.
It is that, Chris. I suppose we're all global citizens in some way. Those of us who are behind the Sweet Freedom fledgling record label, we're all rock music tragics from way back, and we've done a fair bit of travelling, living in other countries, playing in other countries, and yes, we've seen many disturbing things. So we've come back and found this opportunity to work with people who are struggling and use music as a vehicle, I guess, to bring them together. So evidence is there in each of those albums that we know we're on the right track.
Well, let's hear Michael sing then.
Stand. shout together. Silence will be broken. We light a candle to watch the flames and slowly learn to hope again. We light a candle to watch the flames and slowly learn to hope again.
මට තාමත් අහිත්තේ මත යැපෙන්නට බෑ මටම කියලා රැකියා අවකාශය
හේ ගන්ජි තාජියා ති වොමෙන චිචි
por favor escúchennos entiéndannos escuchen nuestras experiencias
කරුණාකර අපව තේරුම් ගන්න අප සමග වාඩි වෙලා අපගේ කතාවට සවන් දෙන්න
එන්නේ නම්බාද පරියාලේන කොබමයි රිතර
තොරසෝ මනුම් නගර කාලා දරග මත් ෆෝනගර් යෝනා
That was Light a Candle from the Normal Days album. The candle being the international symbol for a small light in the dark that helps us find our way, particularly important for those who are fleeing their country in fear of persecution, who are trying to find a new home in distant shores. Cécile Pouyer from the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, has just called into our airwaves. How many asylum seekers are there in the world today, Cécile?
Well, there are about 700,000 asylum seekers around the world, which means people who are seeking refuge because of fear of persecution. There are also about 10 million refugees, which means people who have crossed an international border asking for protection because of this fear of persecution, notably for reasons of political opinion, race or religion.
So that's an enormous amount of people. Where are they coming from?
Well, the majority of refugees are coming from Africa and Asia. The most important groups is coming from Afghanistan. There are about 2 million Afghans around the world, especially in Pakistan and Iran. We also have about 2 million Iraqis who've taken refuge in Jordan and Syria, considering the situation, political situation in Iraq right at the moment.
Wow. When we last looked at that situation, Cécile, there were 700,000 Iraqis in Jordan trying to escape the violence, and they were unable to find a home outside poor, small Jordan, whose infrastructure was completely overtaxed at that stage by the amount of refugees that it accepted. It sounds like that situation has worsened considerably. Is the international community more forthcoming now in accepting Iraqi refugees into their country, refugees from a conflict that they helped to create?
Right. At the moment, we have treated about 20,000 files of resettlement, which means people who are considered absolutely vulnerable and that we refer to countries of resettlement. There are in the world only 14 countries who would accept Iraqi refugees to be resettled. So far, unfortunately, out of the 20,000, only 4,000 to 5,000 have left either Jordan or Syria for resettlement. So it's really a drop in the ocean.
Oh, that's
and
nothing, is
only,
it?
It's nothing, absolutely. And we can only help a small quantity of people leaving these countries because altogether there are about 2 million refugees, Iraqi refugees, in Syria and Jordan.
And you mentioned Afghanistan as a country where the most, well, it sounds like 2 million people have fled. It's something that we're actually not reading about in the papers at the moment, that that's the case, because the Western countries are saying things are stabilising in Afghanistan. What is the cause for these people to leave and where are they going? You said Pakistan and Syria. Is that the sole destination for Afghanis?
some of these refugees have been in Pakistan and Iran for a very long time, because, you know, Afghanistan went through a succession of different wars. So actually, we are helping these people to return to Afghanistan at the moment, especially from Pakistan, when we have ongoing operations of repatriation. However, we also need to help these people to restart their lives once they are back. So we are implementing projects to develop their skills, to help them start small businesses, so when they return, they can do it on a long-term basis.
This is a difficult situation, this situation of returning people who have fled their countries to resettle back in their own countries. I know that that's the situation in southern Sudan at the moment, that the UN is actually assisting people to go home as well. What kind of monitoring are you doing to see that their lives are free from persecution and fear after they are resettled back into the country?
Well, it really depends on the situation of each country. Of course, we continue to monitor the situation, because we very much know that if persecution restarts, people will leave again. So what do? We do control on the ground. We also go at times to see returnees and ask them how is their situation. And usually we keep also a field presence to monitor the situation and to keep on monitoring as well these projects that help people restarting their lives. So it's a good way to see what's going on the ground.
The Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, is a place where people are internally and externally displaced as a consequence of the violence. Cecile, could you run us briefly through what's the source of the conflict in DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, at the moment, and the scale of the displacement?
You know, Congo went through a civil war that was absolutely terrible between 1998 and 2003. According to the estimates, there were about 3 to 4 million people who died during that conflict, which remained mainly unheard of on the international scene. At the end of the civil war in 2003, things improved slightly. However, in the eastern part of the country, fightings are ongoing between different groups. So actually, the situation has been worsening again since the beginning of last year. In the province of North Kivu alone, in 2007, there were about 400,000 IDPs, so people who had to leave their home because of the fear of the conflict. And the situation in terms of violations of human rights is absolutely terrible. Mm. You have new cases of rapes and murders and torture and forced recruitment as well.
Do we have any idea how many people die getting to another country? We've got 10 million refugees. We've got a portion of those who are asylum seekers fleeing for their lives. Do we know how many people die along the way?
Well, we don't have exact figure. What we are trying to do is to monitor the situation of people who are trying desperately to leave their country because of this fear of persecution and are unable to reach another country. So I'm going to take a very concrete example. For instance, you know there is a civil war ongoing as well in Somalia. And people are trying to leave, for instance, to reach Yemen, but they have to do that to cross the Gulf of Aden. So actually what's going on, they have to resort to smugglers. Mm. Who use absolutely horrible methods and don't hesitate to throw people overboard when necessary or stab them. Just for during the last week, there was about 132 people who died in the Gulf of Aden. And we know that out of these people, there are a lot of Somalis. And the situation is that as soon as they reach Yemen, all of the Somalis get refugee status. So the situation is absolutely terrible. And last week, out of these 2,500 people who left Somalia to reach Yemen, there were 132 people who died, including women and children.
That's a shocking story. I'm wondering, what success do you have with Western countries making them more accepting of people who are fleeing for their lives, who are seeking refuge in another area? It seems that the West is probably the best equipped in terms of resources to actually accept people, and yet it is one of the worst areas for accepting people into their countries. What work is being done to actually encourage Western countries to open their doors?
Well, what we're trying to do is to constantly provide information, and the kind of radio broadcast you're doing right now is helping us tremendously.
We hope so, Cecile.
To raise awareness, really, indeed, because people have a common perception in the Western world that they are sharing this burden and that they're receiving a lot of asylum seekers. But when you think about it, just take for the case of Pakistan, who has 1 million refugees, or as you mentioned previously, Jordan, hosting about 600,000 refugees, with a country with a very small size and already hosting with Palestinian refugees. And I think people in the Western world are not aware of this. So what we're trying to do is constantly providing information, emphasizing the situation down there, and so to increase the level of awareness. We're also trying to lobby governments regarding refugee situations that are being forgotten because they are not in the news, unfortunately. You mentioned DRC, and that's the case. You've got 300,000 Congolese living in refugee camps in the region, and you have a terrible violations of human rights down there. I'm thinking in particular, you know, the High Commissioner went to DRC last December, and he really mentioned that the international community basically looted DRC through its multinational, but he's not doing his share right now to help the people. So what we're doing, we're lobbying through the media, we're showing what we can do, which difference we can make, and that it's positive for all of us. Because
yes,
eventually stability in these countries is beneficiary to all of us.
One of the issues confronting African refugees in my country, Cecile, Australia, is an inherent racism sometimes within communities in accepting people in that's actually fanned by conservative forces within our country. This too must be an enormous problem for you in trying to encourage countries to take their responsibility for refugees.
You're absolutely right. Lately, we issued a magazine on the intolerance to explain the kind of myth that's ongoing regarding refugees in general. And it's an ongoing problem. And also because there is a confusion between migrants and refugees.
Yeah.
Migrants are people who are leaving their country for all sorts of reasons, economic and economic reasons. While refugees are people who have not made the choice of leaving their home place. They are forced to because they are fleeing persecution. And therefore, they're entitled to international protection. That's why we're trying to emphasize constantly. So we're doing campaign, information campaign in Europe. And also we are trying to reach the children, doing some actions in the schools, universities. But, you know, we also need the help of the media, of the NGOs, communities. We really need everybody to participate, raising awareness and understanding and trying to get to know people who are different because they can also bring something to their host community. You know,
mm-hmm.
When they come to a host country, they have skills. They've been doing things in their life before. Some of them were doctors. Some of them had very competent people with professional skills. And they should not be seen as a burden, but as an opportunity as well. They can bring a difference. They bring a new light with an energy and a willingness very often to restart their life.
Before we say goodbye to you today, Cecile, that was a very spirited rendition of why people should actually be more encompassing of refugees. Can you tell us which are the main countries that accept refugees at the moment? Who is doing the best in terms of sheer numbers?
Well, you have two things to consider. You have one action that's been taken by different countries, which is supporting us financially. So I will mention, for instance, the United States, which is our main donors, with them $300 million. But, you know, you have to compare that with the size of the population of the country. And definitely Nordic countries such like Norway are coming first because they're really bringing us a lot of support. But you also have the resettlement, as we mentioned before, especially for the Iraqi people, but also for people from other countries such as Sudan, who cannot return to their home place, can stay in the place where they've arrived, and they need to be resettled. And there, we've only altogether 17 resettlement countries. And so what we're trying to do is to expand this basis of countries who are willing to accept refugees and help them to restore their lives. There is a lot to do. I think the international community needs to do more and better, sharing the burden of these countries who are receiving millions of refugees and who themselves are confronted with numerous problems.
That was Cecile Poulet. A spokesperson from the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency. It's very early in your part of the world, Geneva, Switzerland. Today's Cecile. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our futures unknown, lives forever altered. You brothers and sisters have heard our cry. Will you share our hopes as we stand together and the spirit within us? The spirit within us will never die.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Community Radio Stations 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking with Brian Prokopis from the Sweet Freedom Music Project that's unifying people through music to help heal the difficulties faced by asylum seekers. The music that you've just listened to is from the track Alafia from the Freedom album. Tell us about how this track came about, Brian.
It was an opportunity for us to work with young refugees, many of whom had come out of the infamous detention centres in the heart of Australia, and they'd come to a school here in Brisbane called Milperra, a very supportive environment, switched on teachers. The idea is that the students had 6 months or sometimes 12 months to just adjust to life in Australia. There was a focus on teaching English, obviously, and updating their other academic skills, as well as just general life skills to enable them to be more comfortable here in Australia. But their great fear, according to Adele Rice, the principal of the school, was that in time they'd have to move into the mainstream high school situation. Terrifying for them. And according to Adele, it took them back into that anxiety that they experienced in having to leave their countries. So she asked us if we could use music to facilitate that process. So the Alafia Freedom Project unfolded in such a way that we introduced these young refugees to their peers in the mainstream high schools. And one of the schools that became involved was a middle-class high school out in the leafy suburbs. When we spoke to the students out there, many of them said, or all of them said to us, well, we've never actually met a refugee. We've got no idea what goes on for a refugee, what sort of thoughts or feelings. So we thought, well, this is an ideal opportunity. We hired a bus and brought the young refugees over to the school and introduced them. There was the predictable awkwardness that after half an hour or so, we found these young ones talking to one another. And then when we started the music, started the percussion and got the guitars out and just found a bit of a groove, then the atmosphere lightened considerably. And out of that whole process, we then discussed themes like survival and what home means and what welcome means. And so here we had these young ones from different walks of life just exchanging their perceptions of what those themes were about. And so the lyrics started to flow. Ideas for lyrics came out of the participants. And what we do, we take those ideas back and shape them into a song. After a six-month process, we had a song and the young ones were performing the song, and it was a wonderful experience. We involved the asylum seekers or the refugees in the whole process from beginning to end, in the construction of the songs and into the studio, where many of them predictably say, look, I can't sing, don't ask me.
That's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, it's a bit of a problem. We say, well, maybe that's true, but, you know, we suspect it's not. Just give it a go and stand up and we'll get the music going. And so the music is off and others start to sing. And before we know it, we press record when the time is right and play it back. And it's happened time and time again, Chris. We look at their faces and they say, oh, my gosh, was that us? We actually sound very beautiful. And we say, yeah, that's what happens when people sing together. It was an amazing thing. And some of the comments that came subsequent to that were, you know, I mean, these are things that we can't talk about, but when we stand together with others, we can sing about them.
So let's talk about those things that are being sung about. You're helping people to write their songs as well as sing the lyrics, Brian. And I understand one of the ways you do it is right from the start, ask people what they think about at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. We ask questions like that.
And, so in the darkness of night, what are they thinking about? What do they say to you?
Well, one of the comments that stands out when we did ask that question initially in the first Scattered People album, this was a young fellow from the Tiananmen Square situation who said, "I think about lotus plants and buffaloes." It just took us all by surprise. It was just such a, to us at least, such a left field comment.
Absolutely. But so what can you do with that, the buffaloes and the lotus flowers?
Well, we just wrote it down as it was. And in conjunction with the other comments from other people who told us what they think about, you know, they're very nostalgic about how life used to be for them and those they've left behind, a song emerged entitled Hometown. Those lyrics are in there as they are. Lotus plants and buffalo features quite prominently in the first verse. So that's what we try to do, Chris. We try to honour the sentiments that are expressed and just shape them musically.
Dr. Steve Dillon has just called in. Steve's a blues musician and also an academic at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. He's also the author of a new book, Music, Meaning and Transformation. Steve, in your experience, what does music have to do with the experience of asylum seeking?
I think probably the best way to describe it is that music is a common ground between cultures. In the same way that music can divide or separate people by the cultural values in the music, music can also connect them. For centuries, cultures have been blending musical ideas, and one of the things that Brian does is he brings people together from very, very different cultures. And there may be tensions in that blend, but that just makes the music more interesting. This idea of common ground is a place where you can meet, where those kinds of values and beliefs are not verbal. You can actually experience meaning without it having to come to words.
And one of the interesting ideas about coming together too means that a whole set of different values are in the room, a whole set of different cultures are in the room, and all of those influences are being respected at the same time. This must have a wonderful effect on bolstering people's identity, assuring them that they can actually preserve their roots, but at the same time live in another country and experience different cultures.
That's the nature of this term syncretism, which is often applied to both music and theology too, where values come together in those ways. And it's not just about preserving those values, it's also about the new sounds and the new relationships that emerge from that.
It sounds like you're an interesting place there this afternoon, Steve. Tropical Queensland, we can hear some cicadas in the background there. You've been documenting testimonies of how music affects well-being and community. Can you share with us some of your favourites?
There are so many stories, it's really hard to pick favourites. Probably, and this is where Brian and I first came together, Zilmere State School was one of my favourite stories, to actually see the effects that the music program that Brian brought in place into Zilmere transformed that school from being a highly problematic school with almost no coherence of community into a fantastic community hub. In fact, the school was about to be closed, apparently, at the time when Brian came in to record some music. They went in there and recorded a school song called Aim High. And at the same time, they used a song by Kev Carmody and Paul Kelly called From Little Things, Big Things Grow.
Which we should, Steve, I should add for our international guests that are listening that Kev Carmody and Paul Kelly are two of our best singer-songwriters, one Indigenous and one non-Indigenous songwriter-musicians.
Yep, and Uncle Kev gave the song lines of From Little Things, Big Things Grow to that community, and Brian encouraged the children to talk about what they wanted to be when they grew up. As a song, it's had an incredibly powerful effect on the community. Both the song and the video are still being played to audiences all over the world. It was played constantly on 55 radio stations in Australia. When I show the video anywhere in the world, it never fails to evoke a response from an audience. People can see the look of pride and engagement on all of the children's faces. It had such a powerful effect that the school was went from being closed down to being a school of excellence the following year. And now they run a multicultural festival which attracts thousands of people.
Now, this is amazing, isn't it? Going from a school that's just on its last legs to a school that's a centre of excellence. I'm wondering how you quantify this for the purposes of research. You know, when you have the boffins in, when you start talking about funding, people want to know facts and figures. You know, a picture showing a rapt face is going to be difficult for you to actually kind of put on paper as a research finding there, Steve. Are you finding it difficult to translate the music and the video to actual written words that might get funders in and government interest?
That particular case is continuously trotted out by government to show the effects of community hub programs. But unfortunately, there's no real understanding of exactly what music has done in this case. By the same token, when I show the video and play the song, people totally get it. They can look at the children's faces and know that those children are engaged and affected. So the problem is that music is seldom in the conversation about music. So it is difficult to actually document it.
Now, that's a funny thing, isn't it? Music is so little in the conversation about music. That's it's a paradox,
well,
isn't it? How do you get over that?
Well, I work in the creative industries and probably get slandered for saying this. People who write about and talk about music get more funding for research than people who actually make it.
Mm.
I mean, there's some really quite strong sociological arguments about why the text seems to have more power than the sound itself. Given the fact that we're working in a digital world now, we can actually do that. We can have write about Brian's work and click on a link and hear the song while we're reading about it. So it's quite possible to bring music back into the conversation about music.
So moving away from the shores of Australia, what's your favourite international example at the moment, Steve?
There's a project in Canada, in Toronto, called the One World Foundation. And they run similar programs within multicultural communities and also with refugees. They're considerably better funded than Brian and I. They actually have quite well-appointed studios built in a school. They bring in people from the community to record in those studios. And then they also have an outreach program which takes recording gear out into the communities. And it's a highly successful program.
In what way? What are the outcomes that make it so successful?
Its success is probably measured most easily just by the engagement of the children. I mean, in these cases, it's about children attending school and their self-esteem. Quite often, these kids are disengaged and they don't attend school, they don't do well at school. And these programs actually, for a start, they bring them to school. I've sent a program here in Brisbane where I've got a lovely soundbite of a kid saying, "It's the only reason I came to school today," because of the program. Again, it provides a common ground, a place where they're not in a situation where they're bound to fail again.
Absolutely. I've heard that on an individual level, the process of singing means that it's difficult to be angry. How does music make us more resilient, more able to engage with the world, be stronger in ourselves?
There's a great deal of research going on about singing and health. I'm a part of a British study that's looking at old people and singing at the moment. And there is quite a bit of research on how that makes you feel good about yourself.
And what are the results? They're saying that it does have an impact on people's well-being, their feeling of contentedness, for instance. What is the results actually saying?
Well, I mean, this is looking particularly at older people and the aged population. But if I'm to cite my own theories at the moment, I consider that you need to get a personal, social and cultural meaning from the experience. So personally, you've got to feel good about your relationship with music and that feeds your identity. Socially, you get this connection with other people, which is a wordless connection with other people within really quite strict boundaries. So you can't go wrong. Your relationship with other people is bounded by the music itself. And the cultural impact is quite profound too. I mean, when you sing on a recording and people, like in Brian's case, buy the recording or listen to it and download it and all of those kinds of things, that gives you cultural feedback, which says affirms your place in that community and your sense of worth in the community. But who knows what the biological ones are? They're still trying to determine those kinds of things at the moment. I mean, the obvious one is that singers are happier because breathe in more oxygen.
Oh, I'd like to bring in Brian Prokopis into our conversation now. Brian, your music production house is called Sweet Freedom. Why the name?
I suppose following on from what Steve has been saying, we recognise that for people to have an experience that enables them to look at themselves differently, and I think of the asylum seekers, I think of the Zulmir kids who, subsequent to that project, were invited to sing at various conferences, national conferences and international conferences. And these are young ones who had never seen the ocean, and here they were travelling down to the Gold Coast to sing at the Marriott Hotel. We could see their faces and we knew that something good is happening here. So being able to have an experience that enables a person to see themselves differently and to experience skills that they didn't know they had has a kind of a liberating effect, we find. And it's a sweet feeling when you have those kind of experiences. So the concept of Sweet Freedom seemed to fit very appropriately.
Indeed. Well, what an exciting project to be involved with. Thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on it, both of you, Brian and Stephen. That was Steve Dillon. Steve's latest book is Music, Meaning and Transformation, available through Cambridge Scholars Publishing and also online at Amazon. He's also the director of an online website documenting innovation in sound communities. Check it out at www.savetodisc.net. Very interesting work. Great to talk with you today, Steve. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers, and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program or the music that we've been playing in it, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Brian Prokopis, a music producer for the up-and-coming record label Sweet Freedom. The next collaboration that we're going to hear comes from your Scattered People album, Brian. It's called Labyrinth Sirohortu. What's the story behind this one?
The Scattered People album itself was made in collaboration with asylum seekers from various countries. That particular track related to East Timor. One of our team, who was a former refugee, Afonso Cortareal, from East Timor, told us his story. He'd been a refugee in Portugal, West Timor, and eventually found his way to Australia. But a lasting memory that would never go away was the sight of children's coffins back in East Timor during the ongoing conflict. Yeah, such a disturbing vision for him that he brought it to the table when we were writing songs.
And this must be the hard bit, Brian. How do you do, like, that is an incredibly negative image. It must be hard then to be working with those negative images and making them into something that literally sings.
Yeah, Chris, I don't know how that happens, but we just trust in the capacity of music to reflect those heavy realities, as Afonso did with Labarik. We just encouraged him to write about the disturbing vision that he had, and he did, and just put it down in Tetum, the language that he was familiar with. And I suppose within it was an outcry of frustration, of sadness. But in being able to express it and sing it with others from various countries, we all spent quite a bit of time learning how to pronounce the Tetum word. Mm. I mean, it had its kind of magic, I guess. Afonso felt really supported.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. Well, let's hear it. Let's hear what it sounds like now, Brian. This is Afonso Cortareal singing Labyrinth Sirohortu.
La Paris. sei Deus, dança macame susa, dança mac sei Deus, dança macame susa.
Was Labarik Sirahortu from the Scattered People album. More about where you can get that later in the program, because now a very special guest has just dropped into our airwaves. Kirsty Sord Guzmão is Timor-Leste's First Lady, wife to the now Prime Minister Xanana Guzmão, a dynamic duo in East Timor's successful fight for independence from Indonesia. The displacement of Timor-Leste's people from internal conflict is one of the country's hottest issues at the moment. Back in 1999, when the overwhelming majority of East Timorese voted for independence from Indonesia, the Indonesian military and pro-Indonesian militias swept through the country on a scorched earth campaign, leaving behind between 1,000 and 2,000 people dead and more than two-thirds of the country's 850,000 people displaced. Now, more than 8 years later, there are still East Timorese living in refugee camps in West Timor. Kirsty, aside from being the wife of the now Prime Minister, is also the chairwoman of Alola, an East Timorese NGO for the empowerment of women. Alola is the childhood nickname of a young East Timorese girl, Juliana dos Santos, who was kidnapped during the violence in 1999 and taken to Indonesian West Timor. She was just 15 years old at the time. Tell us what's happened to her since then, Kirsty.
Well, we've tried to stay in touch with Juliana's situation through her parents, and that's not been easy given communication difficulties between Swai, where she comes from, and Dili, where we're based, and also given the fact that news from Juliana has been quite sporadic, so her parents rely on, you know, word of mouth information about what her situation is from people coming from West Timor to East Timor. But one of our staff is travelling to Swai to meet with her family, in fact, today. So, you know, in spite of the difficulty, the tyranny of distance, the difficult, very controlled circumstances in which she is living, by all accounts, we have done our best to try and keep abreast of her situation and to establish whether there's anything that we can do. Obviously, we feel, since we've adopted her name and her story as the emblem for our organisation, we feel that we have a duty to her personally and to keeping apprised of developments with her situation.
Because Juliana's case was a really interesting one, wasn't it? She went to West Timor, she was kidnapped by militia and eventually married one of the middle officers within those militias and has had children with him. And there's a psychology at play that makes her case really interesting, isn't there? That she is in West Timor at the moment, that there has been a constant dialogue with her, but there is now a distance between Juliana and her country. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it's become really apparent since starting to deal with her case when I became aware of it in 2001, that there's a whole range of factors at play here. There's the political and the military. There's the fact that she probably was witness to one of the worst atrocities in the post-ballot period in 1999 and therefore could implicate a whole lot of people on the Indonesian side and various East Timorese collaborators as well if she was to come back to Timor and to testify in a court of law here. There's also issues of relationships between Indonesia and East Timor and trying to keep things on an even keel and not wanting to sacrifice that relationship to the interests of one particular young woman. But there's also very real psychological issues too. In studying Juliana's situation, I came to understand terms like the Stockholm syndrome, where people who have been held captive to a kidnapper or someone else over an extended period of time actually come to identify with that person. And I think we're probably seeing this in Juliana's case to some extent. I think she has also not had access to information about what has been happening in Timor since the transition period and therefore has probably fallen prey to a whole lot of campaigns of propaganda about Timor, probably being told that she'll have her throat slit if she comes back, that she would live in dire poverty and that Timor's a failed state that's going to be subject to civil strife and unrest for a long period of time. You know, and I don't think she's had any access to independent sources of information to verify whether that's the case or not.
Yes.
And the reality is that she does come from a family, you know, mum and dad are poor as church mice.
Mm.
And she's probably really weighing up, well, where can I best offer my kids a future and where can I guarantee that I can feed them and educate them and clothe them? And whilst it must be a pretty awful and very degrading experience to be the, you know, fourth or fifth wife of this militia leader that's kidnapped you and turned you into a war trophy, by the same token, I guess probably her lot wouldn't have been all that different if she'd been here in Timor. She probably would have been married off early and been leading a kind of more or less captive existence anyway. So she's probably thinking, well, at least I've got a roof over my head and I can feed my kids, and that's a known.
I mean, because Timor is changing, but that change will be slow. I can hear your kids in the background, actually. They're laughing, they're playing in the sun, they're playing in the water. I'm wondering, though, it's really the case that if people are fleeing from violence within a country, it must be so hard for them to eradicate that picture from their memory, the association of violence with a particular place.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've just been talking with colleagues earlier today about the trauma that many Timorese still live with and the fact that there hasn't been an opportunity for them to deal with that trauma, with the complex interpersonal relationships within communities and within families often, which is, you know, the violence has pitted one family member against the other in the past, and there hasn't really been an opportunity over these last years for people to come to terms with that, and so they're carrying around a lot of stress and strain and unfinished business, which certainly makes the whole process of peace building pretty complicated.
Moving on to Indonesia and your need at the moment, given your proximity in the region, to actually broker a stable relationship with Indonesia. How is this impacting on your diplomatic relations? Juliana is not the only person who's displaced at the moment. I understand there's a number of East Timorese still within Indonesia. How many people are we talking about, and what kind of problems does that pose for the government?
Look, I don't have precise figures, and I'm not sure that anyone actually knows precisely how many people in Juliana's circumstances or similar are actually still in Indonesia. I'm personally aware of a handful of cases of other minors, you know, people who at least at the time of the post-ballot violence were still children and whose records files are still open. The Timorese government, with very limited, you know, human capacity and financial resources, is doing its best to work together with the Indonesian authorities to try and have many of those people repatriated. But as with Juliana's case, there's conflicting interests there in many cases. It's very difficult for a whole range of reasons. One, diplomatic, as you say, but I think probably the government feels that it's expedient at times to sacrifice the interests of individuals for the bigger relationship and the peace and stability that guarantees. I can't say whether that's the right approach or not. Obviously, as someone that takes a keen interest in the issues of women and children, you know, I'd like very much to see those issues resolved, because like many people in NGOs here, you know, I have to deal with the mothers, the fathers, the brothers, the sisters of those people that are still displaced, and deal with their anguish and their pain over not knowing their whereabouts and their circumstances. But, I mean, I think there is clearly wisdom too in pursuing a policy of reconciliation with with Indonesia. Clearly it's in nobody's interest for there to be a return to the hostilities of the past, and I don't think there's really any very real prospect of that, but I think for a whole host of reasons it's in Timor's interest to be the best of friends and partners with Indonesia.
Yes, of course, and also the best bet for the long-term security of nationals both inside and outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that the diaspora, the people outside the country at the moment who are looking at East Timor, the more stable the area, the more encouraged one would think they would be to return to their homeland.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, what can East Timor, Timor-Leste, do to encourage people back? There must have been a fairly steady stream of people who were fleeing the country for a number of decades before 1999 and the violence of 1999, Kirsty.
Yes. I mean, the policy over the past few years has been basically to let those Timorese in the diaspora who are undecided about whether they wanted to come back, to actually let them make that decision over time and not encourage them to return in a hurry and put further strains on, you know, housing and the need for services. But many of them are highly skilled and we do need their skills, but they also have families, many of them, with children that have their roots in Australian culture, Australian language. You know, it's quite a big thing to uproot them from that and expect them to integrate back into Timorese society easily. So, you know, again, very complex, very serious issues across the board.
So while we've got you on the phone today, Kirsty, what are the big issues facing East Timor this year? What issues are being talked about in your press and around your dinner table?
Well, I mean, there's immediate short-term ones. There's the problem of Major Alfred Orenado, which continues to preoccupy my husband and the government. Perhaps even bigger than that is the question of the IDPs and resolving very complex issues that underpin that situation. I think reform is a big priority for my husband's government, actually looking at the composition of government, particularly people in sort of senior middle management positions, and establishing whether they're the right people for the job and making sure that they have the best interests of the country and not necessarily a party political line to push, but, you know, the national interest at heart, and that they are capable technically, professionally, to do the job that they've been asked to do. But there are so many competing priorities, as has been the case since, you know, 2000, 2001.
Absolutely.
To balance them all.
And finally, we've talked about the 1999 displacements, but of course there was a whole string of displacements as a consequence of the internal violence within East Timor last year. What's the situation now, Kirsty?
Precise figures are hard to come by, but the figures that you most commonly hear are that there are somewhere in the region of 10 to 20,000 internally displaced people still resident in Dili, still spread across, you know, a large number of makeshift camps, and that there's something like 70,000 beyond Dili. I don't have any precise way of verifying which are the correct figures, but it's far too many people to be living in circumstances where they don't have access to clean water and proper medical services, you know, and we'd like to resolve it. And I know Shanana is making it an absolutely huge priority. He's meeting with some individual camp members and the leadership of different camps to actually identify what are the issues to getting the IDPs returning home.
Internally displaced people. And we should, just for our friends who are listening, Kirsty, remind people about the violence last year and very briefly what started it. Could you just give us a brief description of where we are with that now and what caused the violence in the first place?
Sure. Everyone has different interpretations of what the root causes of the crisis were, but a combination of tensions within the security forces, alleged discrimination, particularly amongst members of our defence force. And I think essentially the ensuing tensions and violence really just drew attention to the fact that we have very weak state institutions. We haven't yet developed the mechanisms to deal appropriately with grievances when they appear, and that there still, unfortunately, is a culture of violence which hasn't yet been condemned as a totally inappropriate way of dealing with conflict and tension when it arises.
It was great for you to drop into our airways today, Kirsty. Great to talk with you and so interesting to hear about Timor-Leste. Kirsty Sword-Guzmão is Timor-Leste, or is Timor's First Lady, wife to the now Prime Minister Xanana Guzmão and chairwoman of Alola, an NGO for the empowerment of women in East Timor. Find out more at www.alolafoundation.org. Kirsty, great to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Fantastic to talk to you too.
Bye, Kirsty. It's a country with lots of challenges, not the least of which is attracting back to its country, its talent and its people. Brian, I'm wondering if Afonso has told you, Afonso being the person who sung that song that we've just listened to before Kirsty started speaking, what does he tell you about why he's now settled in Australia and isn't returning to East Timor?
Well, Chris, Afonso is keen to go back. Since he's been in Australia, he's managed to secure a degree in international relations, and he wants to, as he described it to me, be part of the solution back there. However, the country now doesn't have the infrastructure for him to be able to contribute. He says, gee, if I went back there, I'd be part of the problem. I'd just be another unemployed person. So he's very much keeping his ear to the ground and waiting for the opportunity to return.
Which is actually what Kirsty was just telling us about. Brian, we've run out of time today. It was just great having you on the program today as our co-host. So, Brian, before you leave us, where to from here for Sweet Freedom?
We're involved in another couple of projects this year. The productions will continue. I mean, we recognise very well that we're musicians and we're producers. We don't have too many skills by way of promotion and marketing. So we're trying to do something about that and appreciating the assistance of others who guide us along the way. And in saying that, any of you dear listeners out there who would like to in some way be involved or would like us to perhaps mentor some local projects in your countries, please make contact with us. We'd love to hear from you.
And that's an international offer, Brian, by the sound of it.
It is, all right. And we see ourselves as heading in an international direction. Yeah, we certainly believe in what we do.
That was Brian Prokopis, one of the music producers of the up-and-coming record label Sweet Freedom. Brian, you champion. That was fantastic.
Thanks, Chris.
And for those of you who have enjoyed today's music, we've been featuring three CDs, Scattered People, Normal Days and Alafia. They're from a most amazing Australian project that produces social justice music in collaboration with the people who both sing and star in the songs. The performers are themselves asylum seekers, singing lyrics they wrote about their experiences in fleeing one country and waiting to find a home in another. And, importantly, profits from the sale go to those who've participated. Check it out on the Sweet Freedom website, www.sweetfreedom.org. And if you want to hear those songs again, just visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of all our programs just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders. If you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website's where it's at. That address again, newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again soon.